the Alaska Gas Project is one that needs support at the highest levels, and we're going to make that happen.
Federal provisions designed to help an Alaska gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 8th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a fuel spill near the Iliamna River.
Their intentions are to float these tanker trailers down the Iliamna in an attempt to save money rather than bringing it up from Dillingham.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Provisions that would help finance an Alaska natural gas pipeline are in the Senate energy bill being hammered out this month. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she got support from Energy Committee Democrats to insert the proposals in the base text of the oil and gas part of the bill. That will come up for debate tomorrow at committee markup sessions. But Murkowski says at this point, the gas line provisions have bipartisan support. They would sweeten loan guarantees and speed up the process to get them.
Getting these Alaska provisions in the base text was pretty significant. I think it indicates that even though there's so much going on in different areas in terms of energy development, a recognition that the Alaska Gas Project is one that needs support at the highest levels, and we're going to make that happen.
Murkowski's office created the provisions and got support from Energy Committee Chairman Democrat Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico. Some of them are also included in a separate bill being pushed by North Dakota Democrat Senator Byron Dorgan. They would increase the amount of a possible loan guarantee for construction of a pipeline from $18 billion to $30 billion, plus future inflation. Murkowski says that should help cover increased construction costs and account for a dip in natural gas prices. The provisions would also allow the Federal Financing Bank to make a direct loan and clears up ambiguity in past language to ensure that a loan guarantee would be for up to 80% of the total pipeline cost. Murkowski says some added technical amendments would speed up issuance of a loan guarantee.
We're looking to really help with not only the financing, but to do what we can to reduce the overall cost of the project, reduce the financing costs, hopefully reduce the risk of cost overruns. This helps, whether it's the Denali project or whether it's TransCanada.
Another provision would grant the potential for a right-of-way permit through Denali National Park for a smaller bullet gas line if a small in-state line is selected to run along the park's highway. Murkowski says she's not pushing for a bullet line to take that route, but wants to be ready if it does. There's also a provision to open an Alaska-based permit office for offshore development projects. The Senate Energy Committee will tackle the oil and gas parts of its massive energy bill tomorrow morning. Seven candidates are vying for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's mayor's seat. The outcome of tomorrow's election could hold long-range implications for changes in the area's lifestyle, economy, and maybe its government. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Considering the number of candidates in the race, chances of a runoff are good. Of the two strongest candidates, only former Alaska Attorney General Talis Kohlberg agreed to an interview. Steve Menard declined. Kohlberg was born and raised in the Valley, and despite stints in college and law school outside and a term in Juneau, has pretty much lived there his whole life. He says it is growth that will determine the borough's future.
The Valley has become increasingly significant to the rest of the state. Demographically, 20 years, 30 years from now, it'll be larger than Anchorage. It's already past Fairbanks. We're basically number two in population. The significance of that is huge in the long run, but it's become more and more apparent, especially in what we call the core area, that what folks do on their land can impact quality of life, the value of property on adjoining pieces of land.
Kohlberg says that the borough is not designed to support its current population, and that's caused a lot of frustration. Roads need upgrades, and the current borough effort to update zoning codes to deal with increasing urbanization has miffed some residents who want to keep the hands-off rural lifestyle.
You know, you could make the argument that those outlying areas really would warrant a separate borough of sorts, and that the core area would be more on the model of Anchorage or Fairbanks with its own population. So there is increasingly a schism, I think, that shows up in polling.
Kohlberg, who spent 6 years on the borough assembly, says that the borough's weak mayor form of government needs shaking up, too. As it stands, the borough mayor has no direct connection with borough administrative staff.
Right now, the manager really has to dance to please at least four assembly people, and that theoretically could change every year with a different election. Whereas if you had a strong mayor, you would have some sense that for at least 3 years you'd have more or less a clear idea of what the agenda would be of that particular mayor.
The mayor can veto an assembly decision, however. Kohlberg says any change in the mayor's role will take several years. He calls himself a fiscal conservative and is concerned about increases in the borough's budget over the past 6 years. Other candidates echo similar concerns. Emil Butch Fonden, a Teamster, says the borough needs to trim its budget. He's against the borough's ski area plans for Hatcher Pass, and he thinks more money ought to be spent on Valley seniors. Candidate Frank Shore agrees that the borough needs a strong mayor, and he thinks that the borough administration is overstaffed.
We start trimming down the people not doing a full day's work, and that will cut down overhead expense right there.
Shore is against a sales tax. Career Army man Bruce Walden also advocates for a strong mayor form of government.
We've got a manager form of government here, and that just goes against what our founders had in mind. I mean, as a resident of this borough, if you can't vote for or against the person that runs the show, that's not how this country works. And it's time that we have a strong mayorship type of government here.
Walden, a self-styled music promoter, has a unique idea. He'd like to make the Valley a country music center. Johnny Moose, Liner, has written a book about corruption in Alaska. He believes that corruption in government is the number one issue in the borough.
I'm just running by word of mouth, people that know my name. I have no campaign. I will not accept any campaign donations, nor will I spend even 2 cents of my own money for my campaign.
Liner says the borough needs to trim spending and hold taxes down. Candidate and dog musher Dave Straub is from Willow. As stated earlier, Steve Menard is from an old Valley family with a strong background in borough politics. He is the son of former borough mayor Kurt and state senator Linda Menard. The Matanuska-Susitna borough's election is Tuesday, June 9th. Polls open at 7 a.m. and close at 8 p.m. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A fuel mishap on Pyle Bay Road in southwest Alaska resulted in as much as 2,500 gallons of diesel fuel being spilled near the Iliamna River, although the Department of Environmental Conservation is reporting that no fuel reached the water. John Brown is with DEC and is in charge of the spill response. He says the accident happened when a tractor trailer with 9,500 gallons of diesel was unhooked from the tow vehicle. The tanker trailer rolled down an incline and a hole was punched in the tank. Brown says the Iliamna Development Corporation was trying to get the fuel to the community of Iliamna.
Their intentions are that to float these tanker trailers down the Iliamna in an attempt to save money rather than bringing it up from Dillingham.
Brown says the practice of floating trailers of fuel is employed in other parts of the state also.
In Prince William Sound, they use landing crafts. I think down in the southeast, I think they have landing crafts or other vessels that take these containerized fuel compartments and transport them off, roll them on, roll off operation.
Brown says the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 requires spill contingency plans for vessel-to-land transfers, but Open 90 does not address floating-type operations.
The loophole in Open 90 regulations is a roll-off, roll-on operation where you take these tanker trailers on wheels and roll them off and roll them on, which is the loophole that gets around requiring contingency plans and contingency equipment and everything like that.
Brown says containment and cleanup is underway. He says state troopers have been on site, but it's not yet known if any state fine will be imposed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a training initiative to help break the language barrier.
It's not fair to anyone to use a friend or relative who's not trained. It's not fair to them to expect them to serve as an interpreter when they're not prepared for it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Another summer of work is scheduled for the Army's contaminated Taku Garden housing development at Fort Wainwright. The new 110-unit family housing project has been the subject of an investigation and cleanup since PCBs and other pollutants were unearthed during final stages of construction in 2006. Thousands of tons of tainted soils have since been excavated from the site. Fort Wainwright spokeswoman Linda Douglas says testing, remediation, and construction work will continue this summer.
This work includes excavation, backfill operations, completing test pits to accommodate streetlight installations, and housekeeping duties, which include dust control and drainage. We are also continuing groundwater evaluation, and that will continue with another series of sampling and analysis.
The 54-acre Taku Gardens was previously home to a World War II area communication site, a battalion staging area, a concrete plant, and a dumping spot for metal debris. But pre-construction soil testing came up negative for any toxins. The new houses were built, and there was no indication of trouble until construction crews working on surrounding infrastructure turned up drums and tainted soils. Oil and munitions have also been unearthed at the site. It's still unclear when soldiers and their families may be able to move into the new housing. Douglas says the Army, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the State Department of Environmental Conservation all have to sign off before that can happen.
All three agencies, the Army, the EPA, and the ADEC, will be developing a list of remedial actions that will address any remaining risks and safety hazards identified in the risk assessment.
A public update on the status of Fort Wainwright Taku Gardens housing complex cleanup is scheduled for at the Post's Northern Lights Chapel. Although English dominates, Anchorage is a multicultural community that often can experience language difficulties, whether legal, medical, educational, or commercial. Last week, an Anchorage organization continued its statewide efforts to counter the language barriers with a five-day workshop. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Robin Bronin is executive director of the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, the group which, 2 years ago, created the Language Interpretive Center.
We are unique to the United States. We are the first of this endeavor in the United States and have been asked to be at conferences and do presentations about this community effort because it is so amazing.
Bronin says the center was born from an Alaska court system survey distributed statewide to over 1,000 agencies, departments, school districts, and businesses. She cited three main findings.
The seven most common languages in our state other than English are Spanish, Tagalog, Yupik, Inupiaq, Russian, Ukrainian, and Korean. We also learned that collectively our state is spending over $1 million annually on, and here's the third finding, that most of the interpreters being used are not trained, and the service providers and businesses using those interpreters were not happy with the quality of interpretation that was being provided.
This shared dissatisfaction resulted in the center and its goals to train interpreters according to national standards and become a statewide referral service for interpreters. Bronin says after four community social services workshops and one medical-specific session, the center has trained over 100 interpreters in 22 different languages. The just-concluded week-long workshop was, like three others, conducted by Holly Mickelson of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Mickelson says until recently, most interpreters worked on an international level.
In the community context, professional interpreting is relatively new to community agencies like hospitals and courts and social service agencies, school districts, and so forth. As populations change and people's understanding of civil rights and legal rights change, there is more and more awareness of the need for services to be provided in different languages.
Mickelson says Language Interpreter Center referrals must follow professional standards.
There is a very strict code of ethics for interpreters. They have an obligation to interpret completely and accurately. They should be impartial and they should maintain confidentiality. Those things have been drummed into their heads in our training programs. So if an interpreter comes from the Language Interpreter Center, they know that. But we're still facing the tremendous need for interpreters and a shortage of qualified interpreters to fill that need. So I know that there are a lot of people out there who mean well, but don't necessarily know what it is they're supposed to be doing as interpreters.
Interpreters also need to learn techniques, such as how much to translate at a time, a crucial skill in medical examinations, and just how to handle concepts that may not exist outside the U.S., like a medical consent form. There is no general federal or state certificate for interpreters. The only certificate is based on the written court consortium exam that's specifically for the legal system. Ronan says that exam was the primary target for this latest interpreters workshop with Mickelson.
We are really gearing up to administer the first court certification test for interpreters in the fall, which is why she's here this time, her fourth time to Alaska, because there are no interpreters in Alaska right now who are certified to interpret in the court system, and we are determined to make that happen by the end of this year.
A certification process is being developed for medical interpreters. Bronan says the local payments for center-referred interpreters range from $30 to $60 per hour. These payments will increase for interpreters who achieve court certification. This is Len Anderson.
National Park Service rangers have located the remains of two Japanese climbers who went missing last year on Denali's Cassine Ridge. Rangers employed aerial photography to aid their search. From KTNA in Talkeetna, Sue Dio has the story.
The two Japanese climbers, Tatsuro Yamada and Yuto Inoue, were well-versed in climbing and well-prepared. They had climbed in the Alaska Range previously. Tracks were found and a probable campsite, but the bodies were not found. Families of the two men had the courts pronounce them dead. Maureen McLaughlin, park spokeswoman, says the same photographic process has been used this year to try and locate Dr. Gerald Myers, who went missing on Denali's West Buttress a few weeks ago. This year, however, the weather was bright and sunny, and an even more technical camera was used. On May 24th, while poring over photographs taken, McLaughlin said rangers observed what appeared to be two partially buried figures connected by a rope in a steep rocky area west of the Cassine Ridge at 19,800 feet. The Park Service helicopter was able to go to the site and hover close enough to the site for a mountaineering ranger to confirm the presence of two frozen figures. Based on their location, clothing, and rope color, rangers identified the bodies of the two missing Japanese men. Family and friends of the Yamada and Inoue families visited Talkeetna this week. McLaughlin says the families hope to return to Talkeetna next year. National Park Service managers have determined that the bodies of the two climbers will not be recovered from their current location due to the extreme risk posed to a recovery team. The Cassine search was the first time Denali Park Rangers used the photographic approach to search a vast land area. The search is continuing for Dr. Myers. While the majority of images taken during Myers' disappearance in May have been analyzed, the photographic search will continue the remainder of the season. In Talkeetna, this is Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A Richardson Highway Lodge in the works for 10 years is open for its first summer season. The Black Rapids Lodge sits on a hillside along the Delta River in the Alaska Range, 3 hours south of Fairbanks. The luxury lodge is owned by Mike and Annie Hopper of Fairbanks. Mike Hopper says the project grew out of a love for the area's natural beauty.
The Alaska Range is one of the most beautiful and accessible mountain ranges in the world, and nobody goes there, especially down the Richardson. The vision was that, you know, nestled in the midst of all that should be a lodge that matches it. And our initial vision for the lodge was the Iwani Hotel in Yosemite. You know, if you could build something as beautiful as the land around it, you know, they would come kind of thing.
Black Rapids and two other remote Alaska lodges were recently selected by National Geographic Traveler magazine for a list of 129 places to stay that reflect and define their surroundings. The new lodge sits above the original Black Rapids Roadhouse, which catered to travelers beginning in the early 20th century. The Hoppers are restoring the old roadhouse in anticipation of reopening it as a walk-in stop for travelers. In Tenneke Springs, 45 miles southwest of Juneau on Chichagof Island, classes ended May 22nd. But now that school's out for summer, it could be out forever. The 100-person community is in the Chatham School District, an Angoon-based regional district also overseeing Gustavus and Clukwan. The state grants full funding only to districts whose schools have at least 10 students during an October count period. Tenneke hasn't measured up in recent years. If its numbers aren't up this fall, the regional school board could close the school down. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has the story.
Climb the hill from Tenneke's main drag up to the school, peek inside the lockers, and you won't see textbooks or three-ring binders, not even a backpack. Instead, you might see
Kleenex.
How many boxes of Kleenex are in this locker?
I don't know, but they're all kind of small, so you need a lot.
Some lockers hold paper towels, others...
You keep pop cans in your lockers?
Yeah, recyclables.
But hey, when you've got 24 lockers and 7 students...
Lockers are storage, more or less.
Originally storage for students, but since we don't really even need them, why not use them for other stuff?
The school was built in 1987, and as far as anyone can remember, not only were the lockers never filled with personal items...
Not like notebooks or...
No.
They were never filled, period.
When they were planning for the school, that little schoolroom over there was full with, I think, 20-plus students.
Tenneke parent Mark Meyer is referring to the original school building, a small red house just down the hill.
So they assumed for a continued enrollment of that size, and that's what they built this building.
So what happened to enrollment?
You know, logging shut down, so that was...
Has been tapering off as well, so...
This is Gordon Chu.
And I'm on the advisory school board here.
He's also married to Tenneke's sole teacher, who, by the way, the regional school board has opted not to retain this fall in case they do close the school. Chu posted a March 15th Craigslist ad to recruit more students. It was titled, "We Are Looking for a Few Good Families."
You know, we had over a dozen very interested families from as far away as Florida.
So far, two have filled out enrollment papers.
The Wadoops family with their kindergartner.
Where are they from?
They're Wasilla.
And the Nilsons.
They're a Juneau family.
A Juneau family with 5 kids, all of whom are fixing up and moving into the old schoolhouse. Mother Lisa Nilson was just hired as Tenneke's fire chief. But as regional school board chair Gus Martinez points out, the school isn't out of hot water yet.
The actual enrollment doesn't occur until August. So yes, they told us they're going to be there, but on the face of it, they're still not there.
Martinez says the children need to be enrolled and attending school in Tenneke.
And then we can make our decision based on that.
Not that it's an easy decision to make.
In these small communities, the schools are the heart of the community. And, you know, if they were to come to my school here in Gustavus, I can't even begin to imagine how difficult that would be for us. But all our schools can or may face this at some point in time.
And many of them have.
So this is our map of the public school districts in Alaska, and we have 53 school districts.
Eddie Jeans is the school finance director for the Alaska Department of Education.
Interesting that there's actually something on the legend here. An upside-down triangle means closed school location.
Correct.
Over the last 10 years, 22 upside-down triangles have sprouted across the map, all due to insufficient enrollment.
Here's an example of that. Icy Bay in the Yakutat Borough. There again, that was a logging community, and when they stopped the logging operations out there, they closed the school.
That was in 2003, 4 years after the legislature started requiring schools to maintain an enrollment of 10 for districts to receive full state funding.
Prior to that, we didn't have a minimum number in law. So in a number of cases, schools got down to as small as 3 students. And the legislature said that's just not efficient. It doesn't make sense to require a teacher in that community.
Just to clarify, if enrollment drops below 10, a school still can remain open, but the district will lose state money and will have to make up the difference. Now, the state will spread the funding cut over 3 years through something called the Hold Harmless provision.
It's to help them transition, to plan. There would have been a funding cliff, a sudden decrease in the funding level from 1 year to the next.
So without the Hold Harmless, we have cliffs. With it, we have, what, gently rolling hills?
Slopes.
But for small districts like Chatham, with no city or borough funding to fall back on, those slopes can look a lot more cliff-like. The regional board estimates the district will lose $370,000 out of a $4 million budget if Tenneke doesn't have enough students come October. And that has them worried.
There are 7 here right now, but at the enrollment period, we did have 9. And that's what put us in this Hold Harmless situation we're in, where we have to do something or the funding continues to be cut by the state.
That's why Gordon Chu isn't stopping his recruiting efforts anytime soon.
I kind of imagine that there might be another family of 3 and there might be another family of 1 child.
So there is a chance that all the lockers could be used next year.
That would be beyond our wildest dreams. I don't really know.
For now, all he and the students in Tenneke Springs can do is wait. And come the fall, it's either more reading, writing, and arithmetic, or no more pencils, no more books, no more Kleenex. I'm Rebecca Shear, reporting.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, and Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. The H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska, and there are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands, and stay home if you're sick, and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.